Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, as promised, psychotherapist Richard Hogan. Good morning.
Good morning, Brendan, and happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas. It starts here. So last week we told listeners, you be in today to answer any Christmas dilemmas they may have. So we have a stack of questions already here for you. Are you happy to take more questions
absolutely.
On the fly?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So people can text 51551, email brendan@rte.ie, or you can WhatsApp as well, 087-032-3232. So 087-032-3232 for the WhatsApp. Okay, so let's get to the first question. So Richard, annoying house guests.
Yeah.
Was a big theme that the questions came in. So let's go with this one first.
Right.
My wife's sister and her husband, who live in London, stay with us for 2 weeks over the Christmas and the New Year.
Two weeks.
This is
sorry, can we pause there and say 2 weeks again and just to kind of clarify
that. It, right? This is going on for the last 5 years. My wife's sister seems to think that this is a great tradition. The problem is she's very fond of a good few drinks every night on her own in the conservatory. Last year she asked me if I would mind if she smoked in the kitchen when she arrived, drunk out of her brain when I collected them at the airport. How do I navigate all of that this year?
Brendan.
Do I need to be an expert? Is the obvious answer.
I don't think you need a doctorate in psychology for this one, right? But let's just look at this, right? It's a great tradition for the sister-in-law. Right. But I don't actually think it is a tradition. It's just taking advantage of someone, isn't it? And breaking someone's boundaries and pushing all sorts of things that we don't do. Guests and all that kind of stuff. 2 weeks, I would say 3 or 4 days maximum is what you'd want people, someone staying in your house, if you've been honest. Like for 5 years, Christmas is such an important time when we very rarely get 2 weeks off. Let's be honest, when we're working, otherwise, to have it hijacked. And I don't use that word lightly, because listening to that there, I'm thinking someone smoking in your house, asking to smoke, someone very drunk in your house over Christmas. It's like incredible boundary pushing there. And what I'd suppose the question
but
I'd
this
ask...
this person's clearly afraid to confront it.
But why?
Because why? It's family, it's Christmas, yeah, it's difficult.
Just because it's family doesn't mean that you don't say, hang on a second here, this isn't working for me here. My Christmas is really important. Your sister coming over is fine, but, you know, not for 2 weeks. 3 or 4 days. 3 days, I'd be kind of pushing for myself personally. 3 days here, and we'd celebrate it together, and that's fine. But like to hijack the whole thing for 2 weeks, and for the burden of that, and the pressure on your psyche, and I can imagine that person up in their bedroom a lot over Christmas, just trying to get away from what's going downstairs.
Yeah.
And so nobody should have the access to that part of your well-being just because it's Christmas. And I would really sit down with my partner and say, listen, I've done this for 5 years. It's not working. I find an incredible toll on my psychology. At the end of Christmas, I'm absolutely, you know, wrecked here, and I don't find it actually any way enjoyable, and they're trying to smoke in the house, and they're drunk all the time. So look,
one hard conversation that you might suffer for a day or two or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. But like your partner should be able to hear and understand your position. I just don't think it's fair to have someone staying in the house for 2 weeks like that, particularly over Christmas, you know.
Yeah. You could suggest they stay somewhere else, could
yeah,
you?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's something that I've thought about myself, you know. We all go down to West Cork and I love it down there. It's fantastic. My in-laws are just brilliant people and they're lovely to be around and they're fantastic. But sometimes we're all down there and there might be 6 kids running around and, you know, and the house is full and it can be a bit of a sensory overload. So I've often said to my wife, why don't we just stay in Inchidani Hotel and then come in and we'd be more fresh, because sometimes when you're staying all together, you can not get sleep. Everyone's up at different hours. Everyone's eating. There's always something going on. So you can be kind of like burnt out from the whole thing yourself. I think you might be a little bit more fresh and more
space to get back.
More space to kind of maybe regulate and kind of process. And then when you come back into the space, you're far better.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so I think people's just, social batteries as well. Like,
but
like,
Brendan,
that,
something we've talked about here is social battery. Absolutely. But like, why are we so scared of having a difficult conversation? And why are we so scared of saying, I don't want this in my life? Yeah. I can't put up with this for 2 weeks. It's not acceptable. It's an unrealistic ask. And it shouldn't be asked of me to kind of host this person, because they don't sound like they're easy either. It's not like they're kind of, you know, apart.
Yeah, you wouldn't even know I'm here. Apart from the cloud of smoke.
You wouldn't even know I'm here.
And the singing from the conservatory.
Exactly. So that's something I would say. Yeah,
all right. You know? Yeah. Okay. One hard
boundary.
Conversation.
Yeah.
Boundaries, right. I think boundaries could come up a lot today now. Okay. This one just came in. I do not have a very good relationship with my older sister. I find her to be very judgmental, difficult and uncomfortable to be around. She recently sent me a message which I found to be very upsetting. It's not the first time her words have cut deep. Family is the main reason we still see each other from time to time during the year. I know she does not like me. We were never very close. As Christmas approaches, I know I'll see her again. My question is, how can I best protect my own, quotes, happiness without letting her judging eyes and hurtful words eat in on me? She's going through a difficult time right now. Her most recent message really upset me, makes me not want to be close to her. That's a tricky one, isn't it?
Yeah, that's, but that would be, you know, say, as a family psychotherapist and working clinically, that would be a very common experience, that you have a difficult or problematic or strained relationship with a sibling for whatever reason there.
Yeah. You know, she said there, and it's not necessarily anyone's fault.
No, it's not necessarily whatever's happened there. I don't know what's happened there, but she said, you know, I don't think she likes me. Or, so it's very hard to have a relationship with someone when you perceive them not to like you, and you might be getting a lot of feedback that they don't like you, and there might be a lot of distance, and you're pulled in then over Christmas, and there's a lot of judgment and things said to you to kind of bring you down and all that. Again, and I think this is why this conversation is so important, we have to manage ourselves in relation to the family that we came up in. And so, because Christmas is, there is a kind of a Proustian quality to Christmas, you know, you do it, you celebrate it, and you do it once a year, and there's a soundtrack to it, and it brings you into contact with your Christmases of past and all the rest of it, and then it pulls you into the orbit of people maybe that you haven't been around, you know. So there's all of that stuff going on. Again, I would have a very clear boundary around myself that, you know, people's words only hurt, Brendan, when we align with them and agree with them. You know what I'm saying? When we actually agree, something I've been teaching my daughter.
So she's there in the situation and her sister makes some kind of bitchy comment or whatever, right?
I would never let that sit. You know, I've said I've never allowed that to sit. I would never, if someone said a bitchy comment to me, I would always ask
them. We've been here before, though. You're the troublemaker then, if you
You're not, actually. You're just
have plausible deniability.
You're asking someone to explain what they mean by that. And I'd say, well, you know, if they make a joke about me and say, oh, that's classic, Richard, he's an awful, whatever, I'd say, where's the joke there? Nice and calm. If my cognition gets hot and I'm start getting tense and I'm raising my voice and all that, I'm losing it. But if I ask nice and calm, where's the joke there? You know, what do you mean by that? Why do you have to say that? I know what I might say to that particular situation, I know you're having a difficult time, but that doesn't, you know, give you the right to try to put me down and make me feel negative about myself. Why would you actually say that to me? And you might have a bit of conflict there, Brendan, but that's okay, because the other thing is that you have conflict with yourself. It's the rotwood of your soul when you leave and you're driving away. What I should have said is what I should have said. That's awful energy.
Body,
No. And I would have a
bit. So, Kamir, is that also back to the one difficult conversation? Yeah. Is that something you possibly would only have to do once?
I think it is.
Yeah.
When you do it, because then a person who says those negative things, they're often very passive aggressive. Passive aggression is awful stuff. They don't take responsibility for their aggression and their feelings towards you, and so it's passive. But when you show them that you don't accept it, they're very much less likely to say those things. It's a very corrective thing if you do it right. You know, if you call someone out, it can be an absolute moment where the person goes, oh, this person isn't the person to do this with.
Okay. And how do you minimise? Is there ways and strategies for minimising? Like she says, I only see her because of family, right? And a lot of people seeing each other at Christmas because of family.
Yeah.
How do you kind of minimise the space that person is renting
That's
in your head?
Brilliant question, right? Well, I think I'm going to say, I would always minimise my contact with them, you know?
Yeah.
When they come into a room, you might subtly go out to see what's happening in the garden.
Come on.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
You can do all that kind of stuff.
Simple stuff.
Yeah, simple stuff, but just that. But also, I would say to myself, you know, this is someone who's struggling and they're not happy in their life. And so they're more likely to say very negative things to make the whole environment seem a bit negative, to fit their unfortunate self-limiting belief about themselves. So that maybe I don't take
sympathy.
Sympathy.
Yeah.
To see the mess that they're in at the moment and have a bit of empathy for them.
Yeah.
And don't take the words so seriously and just see it. You know, when someone says those negative things, that's hurt. That's not someone thriving in the world. That's not someone joyous and enjoying things.
Okay.
That's someone really hurt.
Yeah.
That's someone's hurt. Whatever's happened in their childhood, whatever's ever happened in the dynamic of that family, there's hurt speaking there.
And it's much less corrosive for you to feel sympathy for
100%.
A person than to be,
100%.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it.
And a bit of forgiveness. Really important thing that we forget,
Real
important thing that we forget. Forgiveness. You're messy, I'm messy, my family's messy, you know, everyone's messy. We all make mistakes, we all say things that aren't.
We're
all trying to do our best. At times we don't present that and we do our worst there sometimes. And a bit of forgiveness around that.
Do you know what? I'm glad you said that, because I feel we're going to be quite judgy and selfish seeing in a lot of the answers to these things today. But let's imbue it all with forgiveness where possible. Okay. This is from a second wife. My husband and I have been together for 23 years. Every year for the last 10 years, my husband's adult children call to us for a Christmas dinner. We put on a beautiful dinner for them. In all the years they've come, They arrive empty-handed, not even a bar of a box of chocolates. They have never once greeted me or said thank you to me for inviting them into my home. They treat me like an unwanted guest in my own home. I've spoken to my husband about this. He just says rather abruptly, what do you want me to do? This has caused a big rift between us over the years. I've slowly lost respect for my husband for not standing up for me. I've told him they're not welcome this year, and if he wants to, he can go to one of their homes for Christmas. He refuses and says his children will always come to him for Christmas. See, this is what we always do. You know what she says at the end? I can honestly say at this point in time, I hate my husband and his children for treating me like this.
Yeah.
So this is variations on second family dilemmas.
And I hear that word hate, and I'd reframe that and I'd say it's more than likely it's not. It's deep hurt.
Yeah.
You know, it's isolation. It's been dismissed. It's been demeaned, and you know, it's all of those things.
Not been heard, like,
you know, not been heard and validated and witnessed. You know, it's all of those things, right? So maybe hate. I'd say it's more hurt than anything else, but hate is a very strong way to deal with that hurt, you know, and kind of helps us to deal with it. Yeah, there's a lot going on there, Brendan, and I'd say there's three parts here. It's how these grown up children now treat her in her own home. There's her husband's reticence to set a boundary here and to support his partner.
Yeah.
And then there's her own boundary. There's three things going on there.
Okay.
So the first thing is the children and how they perceive her and how they all communicate. We can't not communicate, as psychology tells us. We're always communicating. And so this is a pattern where they come into the house and they don't even acknowledge her, and that's communication. There's something, whatever's happened here, I don't know how they got together at the start and how the family...
Okay, there's a history.
There's a history there, right? And so those children, I would imagine, grew up with their own mother's hurt and whatever happened there, and so they've developed a narrative about the person that their father's with that's very negative, and maybe they blame them for their mother's hurt and all the stuff that went on there, right? And so they're communicating that. But there also is another element in that, you know, and something, this is something I would have experienced personally in my life, right? When I go and visit my father, I meet the woman who he had an affair with is there, right? And so I'm not disrespectful to her. I respect her in her home. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I often think about that because it's hard. It's tricky, Brendan. Like, you know, it is hard because you know all the stuff that's gone on there, and there's a lot of stuff there. But you're trying to, for me, be respectful, because if I'm disrespectful and I'm demeaning someone and I'm kind of treating them like they're like dirt under my shoe, that's me. That's something that gets into my soul. And so I would endeavour to work against that.
Okay, so that's for the kids who potentially aren't listening.
Yes. So the kids need to, the kids do need to have respect for the person that they're coming in. It's 23 years later now, and for 10 years this tradition has been in the family, and they're coming in treating her very badly. So I would sit down with the husband here. That's the second part now.
Yeah.
You know, I would never let someone treat me like that, you know, the way they come in and ignore her and treat her, and she makes this dinner and makes this bounty and the kids are treating her so terribly. I wouldn't allow that now, all right? So, and I sit down with my partner and say, listen, and his response is, you know, what do you want me to do? Well, there's plenty I need you to do here.
Okay.
First of all, what I need here is for you to respect me. And, you know, I don't want, this isn't a them and us. This isn't a them and me. This is all of us here. We're a blended family now. And so your children don't get to come in here and be self-righteous and entitled and treat me like I'm nothing. This is my house.
He's the one who needs to have
she can't parent those children.
Yeah, okay.
He has to have that conversation. Now, for whatever's happened in the past, he sounds reticent and slow to do this. Maybe a bit of guilt, maybe a bit whatever it is. And, you know, maybe, I don't know what I'm just assuming there, you know. But he needs to have that conversation. And I'd ask him the question, why do you feel it's okay? Because the thing I feel about myself when I was saying that is, it's good for me not to be like that. Why do you think it's okay for your children to treat me like that? And are you okay for how they treat me? Does that sit okay with you? I'd put back on him, is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Is that the kind of children you wanted to rear in the world? They don't have to love me. They don't even have to like me, but they have to respect me in my own home.
Okay.
Right? That's the way I would put it with my husband and say, well, you know, you're rearing these kids and they're not, you know, they're adults now, but why is it okay for you? You know, is this okay behavior for you? Is this the kind of people you want them to be in life? You know,
okay. And so he's the person here.
And also, Brendan, I would say here, really important, I would say to him, you know, it's really damaging our relationship.
Yeah.
You know, it's really damaging a relationship that you are willing to allow your children to come in here and be disrespectful to me and not pay it any attention. And it's bigger than just your children here. There's a bigger issue than your kids coming in here. It's the fact that you're okay with me being treated like this.
Yeah, and I'll be here all year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then it's a part of her boundering herself and saying, you know what, if you're not going to call your children up on this, they don't get to come in here and have a feast. They can come in here or whatever and have Christmas with you, but I'm not complicit in this system here. I'm not cooking for them and going through all this and being treated like this. So that's the situation we have got right now.
Okay. There's the questions that are coming in now on the text now. There's grief is coming up, but
yeah.
So you know, a lot of the normal stuff like yeah. that, people who are grieving maybe for yeah. the first time this
yeah,
year,
no, absolutely.
Their first Christmas. But there's an email that came in around that, right? And look, this is an extreme version of it, but it, yeah. it will give us I think it will reflect a lot of those questions. This person says, Christmas has always been my favourite time of year, but this year won't be the same. My gorgeous mum died this year. I now realise it was her infectious love of all things Christmas that made this time of year so special. I'm actually dreading it, to be honest. So I think there's a common thing where the mother, the old family home was what made Christmas. On top of that, my older sister is sick. I have another sister with a long-term illness. Now, then there's the added complication here that 20 years ago next year, our middle child sadly passed away from an undiagnosed heart condition at the age of 15 months. He'd be 21 next year, so he's very much on my mind as we approach this special family time of year. And she says, like, presumably there are lots of people asking about grief. And she says, look, we'll go through the motions, putting up the tree, buying the gifts, splashing out, hoping it'll make the sadness less. I'd like to ask Richard if he can give any advice to those experiencing grief and maybe some coping mechanisms.
Okay. And I mean, that's a very, very heavy experience for that mom. And that, as I listen to that, right, I hear so much loss, right? You hear the loss of a 15-month-old child to a complication, their medical complication, and I hear the loss of them of her mother, who she said was a gorgeous mom, and her sisters who were ill, right? So you can see that through the prism of incredible loss, but there's also incredible love there, isn't there? Because all of that loss that she's feeling about her mother and her infant child who was lost, that's love. That's incredible love that she's felt.
That's a bit Hallmark, but actually,
no, but it is beautiful. No, but it is. I know that is because we can't experience those deep feelings of sadness and loss without love. You know what I mean? And so that's a gift, however short. I mean, 15 months. I mean, I think we all feel that, right? That's incredible loss there. And what I'd say there for that, because grief, Brendan, doesn't follow time's arrow. Grief is not a linear process. Grief is not something that we go through and that's the end of it. Then that's my grieving done. It hasn't got a time frame. The Hallmark stuff is like, you know, time heals all wounds. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. You know, the grief there pops up all the time for her, for that 15-month-old boy who would now be 21. You know, I'm feeling that as I'm sitting here.
So she can't suppress
nor should she try to. So what I'd say there about that is I'd try to express that grief by maybe lighting a candle, just doing something there, you know, that just like commemoratively, having a memory of the child and the infant and those 15 precious months that you had with the child and what that was like. And then I'd always, with grief, this is the only thing that I really understand from working with it, is understanding that that child who would now be a man, 21-year-old man, would want that mother to be smiling when she thinks about him. She would want him, you know, she would want him to, he would want her to be joyful and thriving and to be kind of like, you know, embracing life. And of course, at the same time, feeling the sadness for all that loss and maybe the lighting of a candle or whatever it is, or for the mother, maybe putting a decoration with her name on the tree, just something to commemorate the life that's been.
So that ritual of people going to the grave.
Yeah, very important.
That's part of it. Is to say the grief is here.
Yeah, that's the grief. Absolutely.
But that means that you can then
Cathartic.
Yeah. Okay.
And it doesn't mean that you go back into the day and you're full of joy and light. Of course, you know, you're touching on incredible deep sadness. But the point I'm trying to make is that deep sadness comes out of love, and that you've had that gift and you had a long life with your mother, more than likely, and you've had a very short life here with that infant, your little boy there, you know. And so it's about celebrating that and trying to allow that grief to be present. This Christmas is the first without your mom. And it sounds like she was the person who kept the whole thing going and the festive cheer. And I often think when someone like that dies in your life, first of all, how lucky were you to have them?
Okay.
Incredibly lucky. Second thing I always think is carry the torch, not this Christmas, but carry the torch next Christmas when you've learned a little bit more about how to live with the space that's empty there in the Christmas table. And that's why Christmas can be really problematic. There's someone missing in the chair there, you know. There's someone who was such an important driver of the festive cheer, and there was such a big personality around the whole thing, and they were the social glue of the family, and they're now gone. I would say
take that torch and carry it forward. And that's the meaning then that you take. You're taking your mom's festive cheer and you're the one now leading the cheer. Not this Christmas. Allow this Christmas to be different. Allow this Christmas to be quiet. Allow this Christmas to have a lot of sadness in it and grief in it because you're grieving. It would be an unrealistic expectation to kind of push yourself and go, we're all going to have the best Christmas ever.
Okay.
No, there's sadness there. Express that, go through that, and that beautiful boy that you lost at such a young age, light a little candle and have a moment where you reflect on him and you think about him, because okay. He's there all the time.
And that's all very good advice, and that idea as well, because that'll speak to a lot of people grieving. You don't have to pull out the stops every Christmas.
No, you don't.
You can have a quiet, reflective one if you're a year or two into...
Exactly. Grief. And even 21 years into grief, yeah. And it hits you, floors you. That's grief.
Yeah, okay.
And no matter how old my grandmother, who was 94, I still at times feel grief, even though she lived a massive life. I sometimes feel that grief. It just hits you. That's grief. It's not a linear thing.
Okay. So, Noreen... I think we've changed that name, hopefully. Okay, my son, daughter-in-law and grand, didn't catch that, and granddaughter are coming for Christmas from London. My daughter-in-law, these are like plays, holds a very comes from a very privileged family. She's hard work, highly sensitive, holds grudges, leads a lot of attention. She has issues with my daughter who lives locally. My daughter and husband are trying hard to make allowances. She won't go near their house, refuses to let her daughter, my granddaughter, call to play in my daughter's house or have Christmas dinner there. So my daughter's house would suit much better than mine for the Christmas dinner because it's small. My daughter says she'll give in this time and come to my house to suit this woman, but it'll be the last time. I'm stressed out at the thought of the visit and of Christmas.
Oh, my God.
Please advise. Yeah. See, because, and again, this is the thing. You're not just dealing with your own family of origin. You're dealing with the choices that everyone children. Else made in terms of partners.
Partners,
and everything else.
Yes, Brendan. I hear you. I hear your pain, and you're not alone in that pain, right? First of all, the personality and that I heard there, it's an A-type personality, right? That kind of person, the more amenable you are and the more anxious you are in their company, they're very tuned into that, right? And they can see someone who's agreeable, who has high levels of agreeable, and they can see somebody who's trying to, you know, placate them. And I would say the more you do that, the more they're going to exert pressure and control over you.
Okay.
Do not be complicit in their game of control and attention seeking. Do not, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a vital warning for all of us out there. Just because your son has married someone who's difficult and demanding and, you know, entitled and controlling, that doesn't mean that they get to exert that control over the whatever activity that you're doing. Your role is not to placate one, it's try to make the best environment for all to have a good time. And how wonderful is your daughter who's gone along with this idea to kind of actually allow the Christmas to unfold in a way that the sister-in-law, who seems to kind of really dislike her, wants it. And I would say, no, I wouldn't allow that now, Brendan. I really wouldn't allow that and say, no, we're having Christmas in whoever's house, say Mary's house.
Okay.
We're having Christmas in Mary's house and that's where we're going. We'd love to see you. We love having you over. We'd love to see the granddaughter. This is where we're having it and that's it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The more you placate someone like that, honestly, Brendan, the more you do with someone like that, the more they'll take advantage of you and they'll absolutely run right over all family dynamics.
You used the phrase here before about having teeth. A lot of this is about people.
It's about standing
teeth.
Up, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And honestly, if this is my child, if this is my daughter whose husband was like this, after Christmas, I wouldn't do it during Christmas, but after Christmas, I'd have a conversation with my daughter and say, listen, your husband doesn't dictate what happens in this family. If he wants to come into the Christmas and join with us, we're delighted. We love our granddaughter. We love you more than anything in the world, and we'll support you and all that. But he doesn't get to dictate where we have our Christmas or our family. Someone like that, when they hear a boundary and they see that you've got teeth, they pull back.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So a lot of this is just once making the stand. Interesting you said about her control and attention seeking.
Yeah.
I'm working on this model that I call the CAD model.
Okay.
I think most difficult people, and probably nothing revolutionary here, control, attention and drama. That's the need. And
if
you can figure that out,
it's often
a blend of
yeah, it is
three.
Often
and
comorbid.
Also it can help to think about ourselves.
Yeah.
Am I looking to control or am I looking for attention?
Bit of drama.
Or
drama
here.
Yeah.
You can actually.
I like it, Brendan O'Connor.
The CAD model.
I'm going to patent that.
This will be my first Christmas where my 16-year-old has unfettered access to her smartphone. Up to a few months ago, I had parental controls. She's now spending hours on it. I spent months trying to negotiate it being charged in the hall at night. That's not working anymore. Then a curfew at 10 p.m, which she kind of does during school time but refuses at the weekend. I've tried talking about it when the iron is cold, suggesting connective things like going on drives to the movies, clothes shopping, etc. But she's cut me out. She's not interested. We were very close when she was younger. Here's the kicker. I'm a single mom.
Yeah.
She gets money off her paternal grandmother, so me not paying for the phone credit hasn't worked. Should I accept my powerlessness? The different opinions over the phone is ruining our relationship. Yeah. So this is a key relationship for this person. And at Christmas particularly, not much fun if the kid is not present. Like,
that's nearly every family, to be honest, Brendan, with a 16-year-old. You know, to be honest, she's more like maybe a 14 or 15. She's a bit old, maybe at this point, 16 to be acting like that. But it's kind of like nearly every family with
a
teenager.
So can we come to some kind of compromise?
Well, first of all, what I'd say is, no, you don't give up on your parental authority.
Okay.
Do not give up on that agency. That's the most important thing that you have. In the understanding that that beautiful kid that you had such a deep relationship with is right there in front of you, and they will come back to you when they move through this. I mean, this period of, like, you know, identity formation and trying to exert your own independence and your own agency of yourself and own autonomy, that does come around 15, 16, 17, you know what I mean?
Okay.
But it calms down at 18 when they realise, you know, a lot more, and they're much more sophisticated in their thinking. That kind of, we call it rapprochement in psychology. They come back to the parent a bit, right? So just know the child isn't gone. They're right there in front of you. But you can't have an inverted hierarchy as a parent. It's just going to be misery for the next year and a half. And so what I'd say is, try to bring, the first thing I would try to do with a 16-year-old, when I'm working with families all the time with this, I try to connect whatever parent is struggling here with the child in a way that's outside the rules and outside the demands of the phone and all that. That's definitely coming, but I want them to be a little bit more connected first, because then the child can maybe accept a bit more from the parent when they feel a little bit more of a connection. It seems like the connection is ruptured here. The daughter pulls away and pulls away. What I'd say is, in adolescence, yes, that's absolutely normal. In adolescence, they pull away from you. That's identity formation. That's that whole part of rejecting the parent and moving towards their own identity. What I'd say is, they don't actually want you to pull away.
Okay.
They don't actually want you to be away from them, right? They'll push and they'll make it seem like it. And, you know, I hear it so much in my clinic. You'd be so surprised if you heard the narrative from so many teenagers. They don't actually want you to go away. And so you might need to think about your approach and how to get connected to them, whether that's going for a little spa day, whether that's going getting your nails done, whether that, whatever it is that you might do as a little twosome there, because it's hard when you're a single parent, for sure. And then, of course, when there's money coming in from the grandparents and all that, it's hard to kind of exert a little bit of authority. But what I try to do, first of all, is fix the rupture there, and then I'd be thinking about some non-negotiables that this child, she's 16, right? So she doesn't get the phone in the bedroom.
Yeah.
Right. There should be moments in the day where there's respite from it. And it shouldn't be the first thing the child sees in the morning. Right. And all that. She's moving towards 17, 18, and then independence and all that. But still at 16, you're trying to hold it, but not exerting like a hold you had when they were 12. But you're giving them more room to manoeuvre. You're giving them a little bit more autonomy.
So the phone at the moment is ruining the relationship.
Exactly.
She needs to
take that
relationship over there.
Yes, exactly.
Right? Separate them out. In a different way and then put the rules in place.
Exactly.
For the phone. Okay.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting one just came in. Because I think this whole low contact, no contact movement online, certainly with people deciding to just like
cut
their family out, they're toxic to me
and all that.
And maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. I have an estranged son. He finished college at 21, just locked us out of all communication, I beg your pardon. Blocking us on all media, email, text, phone, WhatsApp. His siblings don't want him back. But as parents, we struggle with what to do, especially at this time of year. My wife wants to send a letter to his work. I feel we're better let him come to some sense, which might never happen. Any advice?
A letter to his work. Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
to get to him, not to get to work.
Yeah.
I got worried there for a second.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, the letter might be a good idea. I think it's always very important when a child does estrange themselves from the family that they see that the family haven't given up on them. The estrangement sometimes can be that kind of pushing of the, you know, the roller coaster. You push the thing to see, are you being held? Sometimes kids can test parents to see how much do you actually care about me, and do something dramatic, you know, the dramatic part of your CAD.
Yeah.
They do something dramatic.
problematic, which is like pulling away from the whole family environment. The fact that the kids don't want him back, well, I suppose maybe he might have been a bit difficult.
You can understand why that might be the case. There might be a lot of drama in the family,
but I get what the parents are feeling, you know, incredible rejection and worried about their child and worried about their psychology and mental health and how they are. And that's parents' worry always. I think I would write to him and outline your feelings and how much you love him and how much you miss him and how much there's an empty space there and invite, you know, some feedback to hear, you know, your experience. We'd love to hear your experience and why you felt that you've had to do this. There's no judgment in what we're saying here. We just want to know how you feel. Can you please, you know, that in that way, just an offer.
So you need to listen to them as well.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Why have they done this?
Yeah.
Right? And there might be something underlining in the child. There might be something there that they might need help with, whatever. But try to hear them and try to give them space to express what it is that they've experienced. Okay. You know, and so why they've pulled back.
Good. Just for anyone who's just tuned in and is wondering what's going on here.
Joyous Christmas.
They were having a Christmas conversation with psychotherapist Richard Hogan answering dilemmas that everybody seems to have some version of, judging by the texts coming in here. Okay, here's an interesting one on a different note, right? And yeah. I think a lot of people, again, will identify here. Can you please ask Richard, how should I manage this inner thought I have that everyone expects me to be expressively happy around Christmas? I know I will be happy and content on the day I've been blessed with health, love and luck, but I always find Christmas is an exhausting day. One is expected to walk around with a manic smile singing everyone is awesome. I'd prefer to stay completely indoors, have all our kids around us and be insulated from the outside fakeness.
Yeah, okay, it's interesting. I think a lot of people feel that. First of all, I wonder who's the they, right? You know, who actually wants you to walk around with a manic smile on your face? I would watch that. I think that might be an internalized pressure that the person has.
People can feel it from the media as well.
It's the most wonderful time of the year. Yeah. And as I said, it's Proustian. I mean, there can be a Christmas to me, it can be like a tinderbox that's been drying there in the heat for the year waiting to
But the official narrative often can be like, we're all jolly. Like.
Yeah, no, for sure. So that's the first thing I would say is like, you know, and I wouldn't see it as fakeness. I would see it as people trying to enjoy the old festive season. You know,
I would try to have a good time.
I mean, it's why the pagans wanted to break the back of winter. And so, you know, the whole thing is the spirit of Christmas is the celebration and the love of a baby and family and parents. And so it's all about love and celebration and all that. So, yeah, it can be a bit over. And if you're a little bit more introverted, what's wrong with staying at home and kind of blocking out the world and having your family around you? Fantastic. Yeah. But I wouldn't try to think about the outside as fakeness because that might develop a little bit of cynicism in me.
Yeah.
And cynicism is never really a great place to be. And so I'd see, let them off to their old festive cheering, and if that's what they want to do, it's not fakeness. They're just doing that. I'm doing my thing. And I don't have to meet anyone's standard of what that should be. And if I don't want to smile walking around when I'm making the potatoes, just be yourself. Be authentic to what you want. Wouldn't it be a much better Christmas, Brendan, if we all had a bit more authenticity for what we wanted?
Would it though?
It would. Yeah.
Is everyone allowed to be authentic at the same time in a good situation? I'm not so sure about that. One here from a mother, and this is going to be going on everywhere as well. We find ourselves this year with just one of our adult children at home with us for Christmas. Another one lives in Portugal. The other one has his own house with his partner. So clearly they've set up their own Christmas now. Christmas. Christmas Day was literally the one day of the year we're all in the one place at the one time. And as a mother, it filled me with joy. This year, I'm already teary and sad at the thought of such a flat day with just the three of us. I know that things change over time, but I'm struggling with the transition.
Yeah.
And this is classic. There are phases in life where, you know, and you're stuck in that. That was what Christmas was. Certain people came and everything. People die, things change. And
yeah, for sure. I mean, that's a very common story there. And that is difficult. That's a life transition where the kids move out. It's one of the major life transitions. But here's the thing, Brendan. You know, there's still a child there. There's still one of their children in the house. And I would say reframe the flatness to a kind of a way of how you can be together and separately. We're in the age of this incredible technology. We can have FaceTime, we can have Zoom, whatever it is, meets, you know. We can connect on Christmas Day. We mightn't be exactly in the same room. And again, I go back to that idea, how lucky were you and how lucky were those kids to have such lovely Christmases that you want to hold on to them?
Okay.
But the more we try...
So this is a loss.
This is how it's been perceived, right?
Yeah.
But the way I would reframe it and say, how lucky was I to have those moments? You know, I mean, I know, you know, Christmas morning, going down, knocking the door, all that kind of stuff to make sure you don't scare someone.
wonderful moments, right? Transient and ephemeral, but wonderful moments. And the more you try to exert power to hold on to them, the more the moment you're in right now is going to be, there's going to be a deficit and it's going to be unpleasant. You know what I mean? So try to find what you could do now with your child that's there to celebrate it. Because if you're there morosely thinking about Christmas's past, you're ruining the present. And the past has been, and the present can be something that you want it to be. So I would try to find a new tradition and a way of being together while you're separate. And that could be a FaceTime, that could be, and building a tradition there where you do something together as a family while they're all out there in the world. And congratulations, you rare them that they could go off into the world, because if they were all at home, you know, they're codependent and, you know, their failure to launch. Well done, you've been great parents, you rare them, celebrate that and allow the Christmas to be different now.
Yeah, very good. Okay, one more. This is heavy, okay? I come from a home where there was a lot of violence. We kids were slapped hard, humiliated, only ever criticised. But what I have the nightmares about is the underlying physical threat of violence from my father to my mother. While he never actually hit her, I never saw it. He controlled everything. He lost his temper with violent outbursts, calling her horrendous names when we were all young and present. He this person witnessed the dad beating the dog, losing it badly with some of the brothers. The strange thing is, he says, right, and this is back to Anne Ingle saying one day that everyone in the family gets raised by a different parent, I think, you know. Some of my siblings deny our father was violent. It's obviously we are all affected. We're not close now. We've never had a Christmas. It's very rare we'd all be present together. Christmas is a triggering time for me when around the siblings, as my father would have done the silent treatment to my mother and us on a few Christmases. He died many years back. Mom is still with us. We never talk about the violence we witnessed. I've never had therapy. Amazing how these memories still come back, especially at Christmas. Does Richard think most grown-up adults who come from violent homes inevitably do not get on, as an old wound is triggered when we're around each other? It's a lonely place. I've never disclosed this to anyone. I'm now in my 50s. Any advice?
Oh yeah, okay, thanks for that. First of all, what I'd say about that and what you said about Anne Ingle, you know, I agree with that, and so sometimes children do get reared by different parents, but I'd say the majority children come up with different interventions for the parent that reared them, right?
So different interpretations?
Interventions. Psychological interventions for how they manage the parent. And the impact that that parent is having on their psychology. And so it can seem like we all had a different parent, but actually what happens is that we develop psychological responses for that parent to keep us safe.
Okay.
Right? And so they can be the placator, they can be the protector, they can be the minimizer, they can be all the different things that a child can do. And so when you sit down as a family, you know, you can... was this your experience? No, because you block it out psychologically. You can be, you can become depersonalized from the events that happened. And I'm going to say this line, and I don't say this line lightly, Brendan. That person didn't experience a disorganized family or a chaotic family. They experienced trauma in their childhood, right? And you know, I'm sure you've read Gabor Mate, and all the rest of it. Gabor Mate would always say that trauma isn't the event that happened. Trauma is the impact that it has on you and how it changes your thinking and how it changes physiologically, it gets into your body. And when a child grows up in fear and all of that kind of stuff, it goes deep into their soul. And so when they're together, it actually triggers their warning system. Just kids who came out of trauma don't like to be around each other because it brings them back into contact with the trauma and the fear that they experience.
Okay, so, yeah, it's classic.
It's classic.
You, all that.
You know what I mean? It's
so that person needs trauma-informed therapy, do they?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
They should, can't fix everybody else or those relationships.
Absolutely. They need to go and do some work there and figure out what this meaning was. Because just because your dad, you didn't see your dad hit your mother, the threat of violence, the atmosphere of violence, the belting, you know, the hurting of a dog, an innocent dog, all of that stuff, it got into your soul there and it's just playing around in your mind and playing around inside you. And I'd say, go for a bit of therapy there in the new year and try to figure this out and live peacefully because you deserve it. You deserve to thrive and see your siblings not as people in denial, see them as hurt, you know, trying to manage themselves in a world that was very difficult from their childhood.
Okay, psychotherapist Richard Hogan, that was excellent.
Thanks,
thank
Brendan.
You very much, and happy Christmas.
Same to you.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.